You are listening to a session recorded live at the American College of Emergency Physicians Scientific Assembly, held October 15th through the 18th, 2006, in New Orleans. Now to our session.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to say that again because I know it's after lunch. Good afternoon, everybody. Now, there we go. My name is Jay Kaplan. I'm a practicing emergency physician. I tell you a little bit about myself, just so you know who's speaking to you. I actually grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana. Went and saw my old homestead, which was uptown, and the water level was about this high on the side of the house. But I left New Orleans at age 18. I told my friend Henri, "Give me some of that good chicken gumbo," you know. And then went up where I had to learn to park my car in the yard and drink my tonic in the parlor. Can you not hear me? Test 1, 2. Okay, maybe what we're going to have to do is close the door. And maybe what we'll have to do is increase the sound just a little bit. Can we bring the sound up on the mic just a little bit? Is that possible? Can you hear me now? Or is it still? All right, you want me to speak? There we go. Is that better now? Good. Okay. Room check. Should have done that ahead of time, so thank you. I don't want you to be stressed out while you're listening to this lecture. So, I was in Boston for 8 years. Then I came out to California and did a residency in family medicine at the University of California, Davis Medical Center. And then was going to join the faculty there when I got invited to come back east and be part of an avant-garde experimental theater company performing off Broadway. And came back to sort of check it out. And 3 weeks after I came back, I said, you know what, I sort of like this. It was using movement and theater as healing arts. And decided to stay and began practicing emergency medicine in 1979. And I have to say, I still love the clinical practice of emergency medicine. I love it really for three reasons, three big reasons. One is because I get to meet some remarkable people, some quite remarkable, if you know what I mean. Those are my patients. I get to work with some remarkable people. That's the team that I work with, nurses and mid-levels and techs and registrars and unit clerks and respiratory therapists and the whole mix. And finally, I get to use my brain and connect my brain to my heart, to my spirit, almost on a daily basis, and that's something that I really enjoy as well. I also would like you to know that I'm the devoted father of three beautiful daughters and the grateful husband of a beautiful wife, and they're my girls. That's actually a few years ago, because here they are now, age 14, 16, and 19. And I am blessed with having three daughters in adolescence right now. And I must admit that sometimes I wish I could get a shot of estrogen so that I could understand a little bit better. But probably my greatest accomplishment to date is that my three daughters still like spending time with me, and I still love my time with them. My beautiful wife, Amber, who wishes you good afternoon, who reminds me that I cannot travel around the United States as I do and talk about service and operational excellence and things like that and not practice it at home. And so just so that you know, one of the things that I carry around with me, along with various and sundry poems and other things to keep me inspired, is the birthday cards that I got from my wife and my daughters last time, because it reminds me about what's most important in my life. So what I want to talk with you about, where we're going today, is I want to talk with you about ER, actually. And let me ask this question. How many of you ever watched or are willing to admit you ever watched an episode of ER on TV? Raise your hands, please. Okay, quite a number here. And anybody, I know this was the original crew, but anybody remember the guy right there in the middle? Eric LaSalle, Peter Benton? I used to watch a lead into the show, and I would get jealous as hell. Anybody remember the move that he used to make? You want to stand up and show us? Can we have some applause for him, please? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. And you see, here's what I started thinking. How often at the end of my day, as I was walking out of the ER, did I have that feeling of, yes, it was a great day, not, yes, I'm out of here? You know, and that's sort of what started me on the road to doing stuff outside of the clinical practice, just the straight clinical practice of taking care of patients. However, if in fact we want to prevent burnout, if in fact we want to have a long and successful career, while I'm going to talk about a lot of the stuff that you and I can do for ourselves in terms of dealing with the issues that we deal with on a daily basis in terms of taking care of patients, it is also true that we need an environment and we need to work at creating an environment that helps us do that. And one of the key things just to put in the back of your mind is this. You know, I was trained as a craftsman, and most of us in here were. We were trained to practice our craft of healing. No one taught us to step back from doing that all the time and ask, how are we doing it? Could we do it better? I.e., be a management engineer. But that's exactly what we're being called upon to do, besides just practice clinical emergency medicine, given the crowding and all of the other stuff that we deal with on a daily basis. In the back of your mind, I want you to think that my goal for you at the end of this session is that you will have some better ideas so that at the end of your day, whether you're walking out of the ER or whether you're walking out of your home in the following morning or when you're going home, that you really have that sense of yes and you can have some excitement about the life that you're living. Now, just to tell you a little bit more about my history, that's actually a picture of me and my dad. May his soul rest in peace. That's at my medical school graduation, and my dad was a physician, practiced for 50 years at Touro Infirmary, which is the only hospital that's still open in Orleans Parish. And when he passed away in 1986, we created an award in honor of his name called the Compassionate Physician Award, which is given annually to the Tulane University medical student who most epitomized what my dad stood for: compassion, empathy, and caring for the patient and family as a whole. Tulane no longer has students rotating at Touro, so we're in some transition there. But just to let you know, he was a real important person to me in my life, and in fact, this is his tie tack right here, which I still wear, and even though he died 20 years ago, I still carry him with me. And he is still my mentor and will be until the day I die. Now, at age 17, I did a research project in the summer, and the research lab assistant who I was there, I was like cleaning up dog cages and that kind of stuff, so I'm not talking any glorious work here. He described me as being an old man at age 17. At age 29, I had a bad back and my activity was limited. And then I started doing some movement and theater work and some dance work. And I'm happy to say that I wouldn't go back to being those ages for anything in the world. And I would like to think that I can stay healthy and remain healthy. And I want to give you some tips that I've sort of learned along the way. At age 46, by the way, my nickname around the hospital where I practiced was not Chief, even though I was chairman of my department. It was Dr. Weiner, because it was said I could bitch, moan, and whine about almost anything, and I had to come to learn that the difference between being a whiner and a winner was simply the sound of the I, short I, long I. That whiners only complained, that winners helped create solutions, that whiners were renters. You know, they came in, they did their thing. Owners were winners, were owners. If you rent something and it breaks, what do? You take it back and you say, fix it. If you own something and it breaks, what do? You fix it yourself. And that could be said for our ER, but it could also be said for our own life. No one is going to just hand us a beautiful life on a silver platter. It's something that we got to actually work at. Now, here's the definition of wellness. And one of the things that I ask you to think about and notice about this definition of wellness, it is that it is a quality or state of being healthy as a result of deliberate effort. And again, in our day and age, and particularly in the practice of emergency medicine, it does take deliberate effort to be well, to remain healthy. And Michael Gallery in 1992, this is one of the studies, and I think the numbers hopefully have changed a little bit since then, but here were the numbers of what he saw. One quarter were likely to leave in 5 years, and 57 plan to leave the specialty in 10 years. And I'm going to tell you that the talk that I did yesterday on alternative practice options was a very well-attended talk. People are looking to do things, continue to practice clinical emergency medicine, and my goal again is, how can we do that for a long time and enjoy ourselves? So here's what I want to talk about. What are the challenges we face? I want to talk about how can we thrive at home and at work, and are there some specific skills that can help us do that? Burnout is a big issue. It's a big issue because the frequency of substance abuse and impairment among physicians is said to be about 3 times that of the general population. And no wonder, because when people come to us, they don't come to us with their joy. They come to us with their stress, with their pain, and with their anxiety. And when they do that, we have two choices. The two choices are, one, we can keep them at a distance, which most of us choose not to do. If we empathize with them, then we will pick up some of their energy. And unless we find some way to channel that out of our bodies, we will get sick. So I want to talk with you a little bit about your balance and ask you a little bit and talk a little bit about Hans Selye and the concept of stress and the general adaptation syndrome and stress response, just so we understand what exactly we're dealing with in our own bodies. How is your balance? If you put, let's say, we put profession at a number one, and we put family at a number 10, and the fulcrum is 5 right in the middle, how is your balance? How many of you would be 5 or greater? That is, in terms of the balance of your life now, family really predominates. Raise your hands. Oh, quite a bit. How about those of you where you think you're working a little bit too much? Raise your hands. Okay, all right. So I would say it's interesting. It's about 60-40, about 60%, I think, on the work side and about 40% on the family side. And I'm happy to hear that because in years past, it's been much more imbalanced. But last year, I gave this talk in Washington, and there was a female physician who came to me up at the end of the talk, and she said, Dr. Kaplan, she said, your analogy is all wrong. Now, you know, I'm willing to accept that I can learn things from people. And so I said, what do you mean? She said, well, the issue with the seesaw is that seesaws are heavily weighted on one side or the other. She said, what about if both sides are heavily weighted? So I started thinking about it, and here was the image that I came up with. It's really like walking a tightrope. See, on the one side, you have your work, the crash cart, and on the other side, you have the washing machine, your family responsibilities, and they both can weigh really heavily. And so it's not really a seesaw. It's really a matter of walking the tightrope, and how do we do that? One of the things that I'm going to ask you to think about right away and even do as an exercise is this. What is the state of your union? Now, when I was chairman of my department back in New Jersey, every year at the end of the year, actually by the end of February, I had to put together an annual report on my emergency department, and the concept was, with an annual report, tell me about the last year, tell me where you are now, where you've been, and where you're going. That was a concept. So I ask you to think about that. What is the annual report of you? And how often do we take the time, take a moment, take a Sabbath from our work, if you will, and take some time to ask, how are we doing? How am I doing what I'm doing? What are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? What's my clinical load like? Can I take something? I did a talk on time management this morning. Somebody asked me how the talk went. I said, I began on time and I ended on time. Okay? But as part of that, one of the things that I said in that talk was, you can only put so much on your plate. And after you get so much on your plate, something's going to fall off your plate, or you're going to end up being so gorged or so responsible that you're not going to feel good about anything that's on your plate. And so the question is, take some time to write down, how are you doing? To say, am I doing well? Is my balance where I want it to be? And if not, what do I want to do about it? In fact, most people in the United States don't think that they have the time to do what they want to do. Not until people get to be more than 65 do more than 80% of people feel that they have the time to do what they want to do. And in fact, this is from a Hilton generational study. Two-thirds of us think we need more fun, often feel stressed, and half of us want less work and more play and often feel overwhelmed. So the question is, what then effect does that have on us? Well, I don't know if you can see this in the back, so let me read you what it says. This fellow on the left says, can I show you something that I'm proud of? I automated a task that used to take me 3 hours. His boss says, well, 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 isn't that just like you? And he says, resourceful, and he says, no, lazy. Did you just turn my brilliant accomplishment into a character flaw? Complainer. Let's just forget the whole thing. Quitter. Or how about this? Life is like a bracelet, Chuck. Like a what? Life is like a bracelet. It has little jewels around it, which are like the little bright moments that come along in our lives every now and then. Do you feel that this has been one of those bright moments, Chuck? Do you feel that this hour we have had together has been like a diamond set in a bracelet? Do you feel that way, Chuck? If you do, you should tell me. Well, yes, I think you're right. Life is very much like a collar. Not a collar, Chuck, a bracelet. And then Snoopy says, speaking of collars, sweetie, I'm an expert. And Charlie Brown says, I remember once back about 5 years ago, I said the right thing. See, sometimes it's one little thing that we can say that sort of sets a whole cascade or a whole avalanche down the wrong track. I'm going to just share a personal experience with you. My eldest daughter is away at college. She went away at college, and my wife said to me, as she was going away to college, you know what, Jay, we really shouldn't help Mia too much. She's really got to make it on her own. So after about 10 days, my daughter calls me up on the phone. I happen to be on the road. My daughter calls me up on the phone and says, Dad, can I go over this paper with you? What do you think I said? I said, sure, honey, but don't tell Mom. Not a good thing to say. Because what happened? Next time she spoke with Mom, what did she say? Dad told me not to tell you. Uh-oh. Took me a couple of days to do service recovery with that one. But that's why I share this with you. Because you see, I mean, as I say to my daughters, and this is a theme that I hope you will follow through this talk, we all screw up. You know, I screw up all the time. I'm no expert. I'm here talking to you about this stuff. We all screw up. If you screw up and you learn from it, you're alive. If you screw up and you don't, you're dying. That's what I tell my kids all the time. So don't worry about screwing up because we're all going to do it. Where are you on the org chart? Does your org chart look like this on the left, or does your org chart look like that? And where are you on it? Now, what are our professional sources of stress? We work at all hours of the day and night. We have the whole issue of malpractice. We have the risk of infectious disease. My last shift, I practiced in New Jersey for 21 years, moved to Phoenix, where I was for about 2 years. My last shift in Phoenix, I'm sewing up the finger of a prison guard, and I have to put a stitch through his nail because the cut is right on the edge of his nail, and my hand slips, and I poked myself with a needle, and I'm thinking, not a bad thing. He's not a drug abuser. He's not actually a prisoner or anything, so this should not be a problem, but I did have him tested, and the next day, I get a call from Employee Health who says he's positive for Hep C. What does that do? How does that feel? I won't ask you to raise your hands if you've ever had that experience. Knock on wood, I'm positive. I mean, I'm positive that I'm negative. I'm negative for Hep C, okay, and all those other bad things. But I'm going to tell you, I lived in fear for a year. Okay, and that happens to us. It's part of who we are. The risk of violence, the risk of impairment. On top of that, we have the unpredictability of each day. There's a study done, this was back in the late 1980s, where they took mice, or they took rats, and they put them in a shock chamber. And in the shock chamber, they had a control group. The control group, they didn't shock at all. Then they had a group that they shocked, and the rats could turn the shock off by pressing a lever. And then they had a group where the rats could never turn the shock off. They then implanted them with tumor cells. Okay. Where do you think the tumor cells grew the most rapid? In which group? In the group that had no control over being able to turn the shock off. Actually grew at the same rate in those that had got shocked that could turn the shock off and those that didn't get shocked at all. Now, think about your clinical experience of practicing every day. We are like rats, and you never know when the shock's going to come, and you certainly can't turn it off. Okay, so we have to deal with that. Now, on top of that, we now have to deal with the constant pressure for perfection. Not only the risk of malpractice complaints, but also the risk of service complaints, i.e. a patient complaint. Add to all that, living in the real world, has anybody had this experience lately? Well, I have, only they were wheeling it away, not wheeling it towards me. Here's a better image, I think. Right? We're talking burnout here. You could talk burnout, burn up. We are living in the real world. Now, this comes from the article in Medical Economics that I shared you with, and these are, you know, sort of all the different characteristics of burnout. Overwhelm, fatigue, moodiness, negativity and cynicism, being critical, also physical symptoms. Whether it be GI disturbance or headache or weight change or sleep disturbance or whatever. Here's the difference. Well-being is involvement and engagement. Burnout is people feel exhausted, cynicism, and cynical and indifferent. Patience and compassion turns into anger, bitterness, and frustration. and feeling of fit and being part of a greater whole turns into alienation and isolation. Now, that's what we're trying to avoid. How and why does that happen? Well, there is very good evidence in the field of psychoneuroimmunology, which is a connection between the mind, the body, and the immune system, which shows that stress does a couple things. It increases serum cortisol and serum adrenaline levels. It decreases virtually all the levels of the immunoglobulins, as well as decreases both the number and activity of natural killer cells. So, in fact, we know that stress causes morbidity and causes illness. Thomas Holmes and Richard Ray, in the late 1960s, did a study where they looked at different events that happen in our lives, and they assigned them life change units. And here were the life change units, and you can see some of them are positive, like marriage was 50 points. Addition to the family was 39 points. Marital reconciliation was 45 points. Okay, all positive things, but here's what they found. If you had more than 150 points in a 3-month period of time, in the following 6 months, you had greater than a 50% chance of a life-threatening illness or accident. Now, why is that? Who knows? Maybe our immune systems get depressed with regard to infectious illness. Maybe, with regard to accidents, our attention gets unfocused, and we put ourselves in dangerous situations when we don't really mean to. But think about the environment in which we live and all the changes that we go through, particularly when you're first starting out into practice and you're not established, when you're a resident, and there's a lot of change. And change causes illness. On the other hand, the opposite of that, mirthful laughter. Burke, Tan, and Fry, Bill Fry, who's a professor at Stanford, they did studies on the psychological effects of mirthful laughter, and here's what they found: the exact opposite effects that classical stress has. And we'll talk a little bit more about humor and about laughter, but just to give you some statistics, the average American child, age 5, laughs or smiles 400 times a day. The average American adult, 15 times a day. So 385 laughs or smiles went somewhere. Okay, and we need to recapture some of those. It was said, Norman Cousins, who was the original editor for Saturday Review, said that he cured himself of an autoimmune disorder by taking megadoses of vitamin C, but he felt that what was more important was he watched 2 hours of Laurel and Hardy movies a day as a way of curing himself. How can we either avoid the stress or how can we channel it? That's where I want to go, and there are a couple of key skill sets I want to talk with you about. Here's the first one. David White, who is a wonderful poet from the Pacific Northwest, I highly recommend his poetry, W-H-Y-T-E, and as well as his books. He wrote a book called The Heart Aroused, Poetry and the Preservation of Soul in Corporate America. He wrote another book called Crossing the Unknown Sea, Work as a Pilgrimage Through Identity. David White said, I heard him say once, you know, we are human beings, not human doings. So we need to take some time to just be. And he also talks at times about having a conversation with Brother David Stendhalrast, who is a priest who wrote a book called Gratitude. I'm blocking on the name of the book. It had to do with gratitude as the heart of prayer. And he said to Brother David one evening over a couple of glasses of wine, he said, Brother David, talk to me of exhaustion. And Brother David said, the antidote to exhaustion is not necessarily rest. The antidote to exhaustion is wholeheartedness, which is being so thrilled and so excited about what you're doing on an every day that you get turned on by your activity rather than used up by it. So, now I put this slide together. Is there anything wrong with those bullet points? Well, to me, the middle bullet point is a little bit problematic because when I first put the slide together, my slide said, make family as high a priority as your work. And I had a problem actually with the way that looked and sounded because as Harold Kushner, a great author, once said, he's also a rabbi, he said, no one's ever gone to their deathbed saying they wish they'd gone to work more. They go to their deathbed saying, I wish I'd had more time with my family. I wish I'd spent more time having fun and relaxing and all the rest. And so one of the things that I'm going to ask you to do is to make yourself as important as your work. and to make your family more important than your work. Because when our time comes at the end, that's who we will rely on, and that's who will help us feel the fulfillment of our life. Work is important, but not the end-all of end-alls. Now, what's interesting about this is this is a wonderful magazine called Fast Company. And Fast Company has, this was a year ago, this was a title page, "What if you were given the choice, change or die, for real? What if it weren't just rhetoric that confuses corporate performance with life or death, but actual life or death, yours? What if a doctor said you had to make tough changes in the way you think or act, or your time would end soon? Could you change? Here are the scientifically studied odds, 9-1, that's 9-1 against you." And particularly for us physicians, when we think about people can be characterized in one broad category. We have some people who I call the green people. They love change. We have some people who are yellow people. They'll tolerate change. And then we have some people who are red people. They hate change. Where do doctors fit on that spectrum, do you think? Are we more green or more red? We're more red because we do things the same way over and over and over again. And the same goes for our personal lives as well. So to change means we really have to take a look and have some effort. And as Gandhi said, there's more to life than merely increasing its speed. Now, and by the way, I'm no expert in change because I grew up in the same house. I grew up here in New Orleans, and I lived in the same house from the time I was a year and a half old till the time I was 18. So I only knew one house. I went to the same school from kindergarten through grade 12, so I only knew one school. My dad never changed his job. My mom never changed her brand of scotch, Chivas Regal. I went to college and medical school at the same place, did my internship, residency, and fellowship at the same place, moved to New Jersey where I practiced for 21 years at the same hospital as part of the same medical group. I've only had one wife. When I say that in California, by the way, I get a standing ovation. One wife, and I've had four cars in 35 years. Drove my first car 156,000 miles, my next car 160,000 miles, my third car 185,500 miles, my current car has 133,000 miles on it. I still use Sensor razor blades, not Sensor XL, Mach 3, Mach 3 Turbo, or Fusion. So where do you think I am on the spectrum? I gave a talk once, and my wife's in the back of the audience, and I'm saying, yeah, I'm a green person, and she goes, no, red. Okay, anyways, time management, when we talk about time management, because when we want to talk about slowing down, one of the things we got to talk about is we got to talk about time management. And here's, if there's one thing that you take away from today in terms of your wellness, here's one I want you to take away. You got to practice saying no. And here's how you say no. And I got this from Janet McEwen, who's a staff with ASEP. Here's how you say no. By the way, how many people here have a difficult time saying no? Would you raise your hands? Yeah, okay. So here's how you say no. Thank you very much for asking me to do that. In fact, I'm flattered that you felt that I was capable of doing that. Okay? And no, I can't do that. Thanks again for asking. Okay? So can we practice that for a moment? You ready? 1, 2, 3. Thank you very much for asking me to do that. I'm flattered that you felt that I was capable of doing that. And no, I can't do that. Thanks again for asking. And now you can practice that down in the exhibit hall, by the way. If you go up to some exhibit booths and they say to you, may I swipe your badge? You say, thank you very much for asking me. Anyways, now if you can't say no, you got to say oh. If you can't say no, you got to say oh, which gives you some time to think about it. Okay? Rather than just saying. And here's one other thing to watch out for. If somebody asks you to take on a job, and you're just about to say no, and they say, oh, you know what, I understand. It's not something that you want to commit yourself to for a long time. Would you do it on an interim basis? You know what that means? You know what interim means? Forever. Yeah, okay. All right, so here's the look for the big yes. There's a wonderful book called Fish by Steve Lundeen, and it's about creating a positive work environment. It's about the Pike Place fish market. Okay. Now, multiple millions of copies of the book. He lectures, he travels all over the country. I was lucky enough to go on a trip with him, and I said, Steve, how do you choose what to say yes to? And he said, I look for the big yes. If somebody asks me to do something and it's not a big yes, it's a no. What's a big yes mean? A big yes means you can put your heart, soul, and spirit behind it and be excited about doing it. If it's not a big yes, it's got to be a no. Sometimes we got to even ask for help. Somebody asked me to do something, sometimes I turn to my wife and I say, Amber, what do you think? Should I do this or not? And she said, well, here's what it means to you. Da-da-da-da-da. Do you really want to do it? And bouncing something off of your significant other or off of a friend or off of someone that you trust is often something we don't do enough of. Finally, just remember Bob Dylan, who has reinvented himself more times than I know, who said, if you ain't busy being born, you're busy dying. Now, most of the people in here, you're good at what you do. And because you're good at what you do, people are going to ask you to do more and more and more of what you're already good at doing. And when your plate gets so full of doing what you're already good at doing, you don't have a chance to be a fool sometimes. Or to try something that you're not very good at that but could really turn you on. So I like to do, when I'm home, I like to do spinning classes, which are like a vigorous aerobic exercise. And I went with my 16-year-old daughter. And Gail is the instructor, and Gail is an outstanding instructor, except this particular day she said, Jay, are you doing, you and Chelsea doing anything after the session? I said, no. She said, why don't you come to our strength training session? I said, well, I don't really want to do that. She said, no, come on. And of course, Chelsea says, Dad, you're going. All right? So I walk into the room, there are 35 women in the room, and me. And they have, what do you call those balls? They, you know, the balls that you sort of stand on? I'm sorry? Bosey balls. Yeah, you have a Bosey ball. And so, and then you have one of these weight bars, you know, and so we do this thing where you stand on the Bosey bar and you're doing, and you're sort of doing deep knee bends. And I can't manage it for the world. I'm falling off. Finally, I just give up on it. Of course, all the women in the room, they're going da, 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 da. And I'm feeling like a total fool. At the end of the time, my daughter said to me, well, what do you think, Dad? Did you have a good time? I said, I had a blast. Because, you know, it's really fun to not be good at doing something sometimes. Okay? We have to give ourselves more of that opportunity. Certainly, scheduling time off is key and important. I don't have to tell you that it takes time to notice the beauty around us and that we don't do that enough. And, in fact, to schedule time for being, to take time for yourself. My wife and I have an agreement. Our agreement is that once a year, for no less than 7 days, but no more than 10 days, each of us can take time off that is completely for ourselves, on our own, with no responsibility for anybody else, and we cover for each other with the kids. Why? Because we cannot forget the fact that when we grow up, we are first man and woman, and then we commonly become partner. And when we're partner, husband and wife, or partner, we cannot forget the concept that we still have needs as man and woman. And then we become mom and dad. We can't forget when we're mom and dad that we still have needs as partners. We still have needs as individuals. So to take time for ourselves is very important. I understand sometimes you have, I can only take so many vacation weeks off, and I want to spend it with my family. It's a really good thing. The time you spend with your family will be ever more special if you have some time to yourself. And one other thing about taking time off, what's the minimal amount of time that you should take off? When you can, certainly once you're out in practice. Minimal amount of time. What do you think? No less than 10 days, in my mind. I don't know how you feel. Why is that? Because it takes me 2 or 3 days to unwind. I start getting ready to go back to work. I'm starting to wind up at least 2 or 3 days ahead of time, which means if you only take a week off, you get 1 day of true letdown, which is not enough. 10 days, minimum. Now, along these lines, in terms of identifying who we are, I think it's helpful to put together a personal mission statement. How many people in here have personal mission statements? 1, 2. Okay. Interesting exercise. Here's what I'm going to suggest you do. Don't buy this book, but go to a Barnes & Noble or go to a Borders and look in the back of this book, What Color's Your Parachute? By Richard Bowles, B-O-L-L-E-S, and there is an epilogue where he has about 20 pages about writing a personal mission statement and sort of gives you some hints about how to do that. I strongly recommend it because it helps us choose our destination and where we're going. And just to give you some idea, here's mine. A little bit difficult for me to share this with you, but I am going to share it with you because I'd like to think that I can teach by example, that I'm a student of life, that I'm a devoted father and grateful husband, that I'm connected to people and to myself, that I can use my mind, heart, and soul to make a difference, seeking guidance, inspiration, and joy. Now, I'm going to tell you, sometimes I'm not so good at this. But every time I pull this up, every time I pull it up on my computer, and I have it on my desktop on my computer, every time I pull it up, it's simply a reminder, Jay, what's most important to you? There are also some other reminders. Anybody here heard of the 1,000 marbles exercise? Here's what the 1,000 marbles exercise is. I am 57 years old right now, almost 58. If I live to the average age of an American male, though I intend to live a lot longer, I will live till I'm 78. 58, 78, that's 20 more years, which means I have 20 times 52 more weekends. So you go out and you buy yourself a jar. That's my jar. It sits on my desk. You fill it with 1,100 marbles. Every weekend that you're not working, when you're not working clinically or days off, you take a look at that jar, you take one marble out of that jar, and you throw it in the garbage can. Some might say it's a little bit macabre to do that, but the truth is, time is passing. And we need sometimes to remind ourselves we need to have a physical representation of what's most important. I could work, couldn't all of us, couldn't we, and particularly now in this electronic age when you can work from home, hardly ever do we leave work at the hospital, right? We bring it home with us. So how do we remind ourselves that we shouldn't always be working at home? Put some marbles on your desk. Other possibility, put together, write a joy list. Write down the things that bring you joy. J-O-Y, joy, no less. Because we are not, generally speaking, a joy-focused culture. Okay? We're an escapist culture, but we don't focus on what brings us joy. So write down everything that you do, joy list. And it could be for me, obviously I can't tell you everything that's on my joy list, but one of the things that's on my joy list is to go to a stationery store and look at all the funny cards. Because there's sometimes when I'm feeling a little bit down when that's all it takes is just to go look at the cards or to watch Whose Line Is It Anyway on TV. That's another thing that brings me joy. But to write it down. And then here's the next thing that you do. Once you write down your joy list, write down when is the last time you actually did it. And it was very sobering for me when I first did this exercise. And I wrote down, and I next to where what I did, I wrote down, when was the last time I did it? And it was years for a whole bunch of stuff that I really love doing. Time is passing. One other thing that people say, and I think this is really macabre, but they say to think about doing this. Write down your obituary statement. If you were to go tomorrow, what would you want people to say about you? And Lord knows, of all people in our culture who know about the thin veil between this life and the next, we know it. We know how quickly it can be here and how quickly it can be gone. And if we're focused on what do we want to be known for and what's our destination and what's most important to us, just do one of these things. That's all I ask. Mission statement, obituary exercise, joy list. If you walk out of here and you do one of those things, this will have been a worthwhile talk for you. Now, I do think that it's important to laugh and have fun. Halloween is coming up, by the way. Here's the point. Laugh often. Laugh often. Now, one interesting thing about laughing is that people generally don't laugh when they're by themselves. Okay? And one of the most seminal movies for me in my entire life was the original movie MASH. Because the original movie MASH said that you can be both a great clinician, you can take great care of patients, and you can have fun at the same time. We have to do that more. Here's number two, think bowling. Anybody here been bowling in the last 6 months? Okay, so maybe I'll ask Dave here. When you go bowling, you're throwing a ball down the alley. What's the point? What are you trying to do? Knock the pins. There are no pins at the end of the alley. Would you go bowling? No, wouldn't make any sense, right? Unless there was a lot of beer and friends and all the rest, right? If somebody said to you, let's go bowling, but let's not keep score, would you have as much fun?
Maybe. If there's enough beer.
If there was enough beer, okay. But that aside, we like to keep score, right?
Competition,
right. And when you get up and you throw the ball down the alley and you don't hit it in the pocket, the next time you get up, are you saying to yourself, how can I throw it differently and knock more pins down?
Yep.
Yeah, but you know what? We don't do that in life. We don't set goals for ourselves in life. We are throwing the ball down the alley, throwing the ball down the alley, throwing the ball down the alley, and somebody says, how come you're doing it that way? How come you're living your life that way? And what do we say? It's the way I've always done it. I don't know any other way. It's the way my mom or dad taught me. Okay? So one of the things I'm going to ask you to just think about as a skill in terms of dealing with burnout and dealing with wellness is to determine what are your key metrics in terms of your own personal life as well as your work life. And here are some potential pins. Time with your significant other or your family. And as I talked about, exercise, certainly sleep. We'll talk about that in a moment. Education, fun, and of course revenue is a goal that we spend a lot of time focusing on, but it is not by all means the most important. Tom Peters, who wrote a book called The Circle of Innovation and wrote a book called This is the Age of Brand You and wrote a book called Thriving on Chaos and In Search of Excellence, he talks about the fact that people in professional services firms once a year put together their personal brand equity test. And their personal brand equity test is 8 different questions or 8 different statements. Here's the first. I'm known for 2 to 4 items. By this time next year, I plan to be known for an additional 1 to 2 items. My current work is provocative and challenging to me in the following 1 to 3 ways. By the way, if it's not, what do I want to do about it? My public, local, regional, national visibility program consists of 2 to 4 items. Important new additions to my contact files, important relationships nurtured in the last 90 days are, my principal resume enhancement activity for the next 60 to 90 days is, and key and important, my resume is specifically different than last year's at this time in the following 1 to 3 ways. In other words, take a moment to give yourself a pat on the back and say, how have I grown? How have I changed in the last year? This is another exercise in terms of your wellness, in terms of your professional side of writing a personal mission statement. You know, what do you want to be known for? I mean, Peters even said, and I did this with all my docs at my hospital, when I practiced back in New Jersey, is I asked everybody to put together a yellow pages ad for themselves. Now, that's an interesting exercise, asking people what do they want to be known for professionally. And if you're not where you want to be with regard to what you want to be known for, what do you want to do to develop yourself? That's called professional goal setting. Practice number 3, my body is my temple. My body doesn't only go to temple or to church. My body is my temple. You are what you eat, and exercise is a great drug. So let me talk about each. First and most important, respect circadian rhythms. One of the biggest contributors to burnout and to depression is not getting enough rest, and it becomes a vicious cycle. So, particularly when we're dealing with circadian rhythms. So I suggest, again, this is another thing you can set a goal for. Set a goal for how much sleep you want to get at night. Question of all of you, how many of you do well with 5 hours or less of sleep a night? Raise your hands. There are a couple of hands. How many of you routinely get 5 hours sleep a night? Raise your hands. A lot more of us do. See, we're not doing what's good for us, and we know it's not good for us, but yet we do it. So here's one little trick that I suggested that actually someone came back to me and said that it's made a difference for them, is if you have an alarm, like I have I'm too lazy to wear 2 watches, so I have my exercise watch, it has an alarm on it. I set the alarm for when I want to tell me when to go to bed, not just to tell me when to wake up. Because I'll ask, how many of you are early morning people? Raise your hands. You're early morning people. How many of you are late night people? Raise your hands. How many of you are both early morning and late night people? Raise your hands. That's what I'm talking about. We need help to help us get enough rest. And there isn't time to go through the whole circadian rhythm things, but you know that the key to working the shift work that we do, if you work a day shift, then you work an evening shift, then you work a night shift. You don't work, you know, then you have a couple of days off before you have to go back and work a day shift. You don't work in a counterclockwise direction. The other key thing is blindfolds. Unless you have a room that you can completely darken and you can put white sound on, turn the phones off, unplug the phones, and wear a blindfold. Go buy yourself a nice blindfold from a pharmacy or use the ones that you get on airplanes. But the truth is, blindfolds can be really helpful. You are what you eat. Eat well and regularly. In particular, breakfast is an important meal because understand that we've been fasting all night. And exercising regularly. And just one key thing about exercise. Most of the studies have shown that you exercise early in the morning, you're more likely to be consistent with regard to an exercise regimen. But you don't have to. Sometimes it's difficult for us with the hours and the shifts that we work. What is true, however, is that you don't have to work You don't have to do your exercise all 30 minutes in a row. You can do 10 minutes, 10 minutes, and 10 minutes, and you get equal benefit. And what we also know is that just doing aerobics is no longer good enough, because if you just do aerobics, then you are going to burn lean muscle mass. And so strength training and flexibility training is as important as aerobics. Practice number four, no man or woman is an island. Make your home and your workplace a family and a school. Now, most of us are used to making our workplace a school and our home a family. What I'm going to suggest here is that we have to make them both, both. So what am I talking about? How can we go about doing that? Well, one of the ways that we can go about doing, and actually let me jump back for a second. What do I mean about making workplace a family? It means that we can rely upon each other. And a school, certainly, where we continue to grow and expand our capabilities as healthcare professionals. And in terms of our home is, generally speaking, it is a family, it is a place where we can rely upon each other, but it also should be a place where everybody in the family can grow and expand their capabilities as human beings. How do we get that sense of family in both environments? This is called the complement to criticism ratio. Three complements to one criticism creates a positive relationship, a positive work environment. 2-to-1 neutral, 1-to-1 negative. Question, where do we as healthcare professionals have a tendency to focus? Do we focus on negative or do we focus on positive? Negative. I'm going to give you an unfortunate example which happened with me, which is this. My daughter, when she's 18, she comes home with a paper. The paper is from her history teacher. Her history teacher says, Mia, your papers are usually outstanding, but this one knocked my socks off. A plus. And she brings it up to me and she says, Dad, I just want to show you this. And I said, sweetheart, this is really outstanding. Congratulations. I'm really proud of you. You must be really proud of yourself. Great job. And she is beaming. And about 30 seconds later, I said, Mia, are those your clothes on the floor? Are those your dishes in the sink? What did I just do? I canceled out the compliment right then and there. 3-to-1. Okay, and sometimes I'm stupid enough where I have to put 3 coins or 5 coins in my left-hand pocket and they don't get to my right-hand pocket unless I give somebody a pat on the back or say something positive. Okay, and I just went in, and of course Greg Henry is speaker par excellence, and I'm sitting next to his wife, and he himself said, you know, he can be in professor mode even when he's at home. Okay, and the same goes for me. I have to get out of being a doctor when I go home and, you know, and take time. Okay, now I'm going to walk in. I'm going to be a husband. I'm going to be a father. I'm going to look at the light, not the dark. Clearly, communication is a skill. We can all do better. How many years have we been in training to become physicians? Well, let's see. 4 years of medical school, 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 3 or 4 or 5 years of residency. How many years is that? 8? Somewhere between 12 to 13 years for most of us. And yet when we become parents and we become partners, how much training do we get in that? Almost zip. My wife and I, when our kids were young, we took a course called Raising Self-Reliant Children in a Self-Indulgent World. Okay. Very helpful. Okay. Even very helpful in terms of bringing those kinds of concepts to the work environment as well. Point here is that we can learn to communicate better. Practice number 5, give yourself a break. As I said, we're going to screw up. The real question is, can we learn from it? And I like Pablo Picasso, who said, I'm always doing things I can't do. That's how I get to do them. And here's one of the things that I say to both my colleagues and I say to my family. No one ever learned anything by beating themselves over the head with a mistake. So what does that mean? What can we do? Well, you know, bad things are going to happen. What are we going to do about it? Here's one thing. Find a constructive way to channel it. Do not isolate. Be willing to admit that you're not perfect and understand no way out but through. And one of the things, if you go down to the booth 335, Artistic Expressions, one of the things that you'll see is there are some things that are just pretty pictures that people have taken. But there are some things that that were written as a way of transforming pain. And whether you write, whether you're a poet or a writer and you can write, whether you paint it, we need to find a way when difficult things come up. We need to find a way to find our way through it. Some couple of take-home points. Start with your own self-assessment. Where are you on the balance? Where are you on the tightrope? How are you handling it? That's number one. Make your family and yourself high priority. Create your own renewal investment plan. Most of us have a financial investment plan. Create your own renewal investment plan. Think bowling. That is, set some goals for yourself, professional goals as well as personal goals. Treat your body as your temple and create your team at home and at work. What I want to leave you with is, do we have sound? Hopefully. What I want to leave you with is a little clip, a little video clip that I find is true inspiration. And let me also support both the wellness section, the wellness booth, which is downstairs, and the medical humanities section, because of those of you that are interested in finding creative outlets, there are a lot of really good people who can help. So let's see if we can get this video clip to work.
We had planned to bring you a story tonight about a kind of prep school that prepares football players for the NFL draft and big contracts. But we're going to call an audible. We're going to switch sports tonight because we've run across an absolutely amazing basketball player that we want you to see. Here's Steve Hartman.
Greece Athena High School in Rochester, New York, has a new, most unlikely hero, a special ed student by the name of Jason McElwain.
Let's keep it going.
Jason is the basketball team manager. For the past couple years, he's been assisting coach Jim Johnson, helping with whatever the team needs.
And go!
Get him motivated and hand out water and just be enthusiastic.
Enthusiastic, to say the least. Despite being born with autism, Jason's father says his son has never had a problem expressing himself at basketball games.
You know, I was always concerned that he might get a technical and they lose a game because he, you know, start yelling or whatever.
Let's have a hard practice tomorrow, all hour and a half, and let's get ready for Arcadia. Let's go.
One, two, three, ten.
Because he has been so devoted to the team, for the last game of the season, Coach Johnson decided to let Jason actually suit up. Not to play necessarily, just to let him feel what it's like to wear a jersey. At least that was the plan. But with 4 minutes to go in last week's game, Coach Johnson stood up and pointed to number 52, Jason McElwain. After years of fetching water and toweling off other people's sweat, Jason was actually in a game. His first shot was a 20-footer from the right baseline.
Was it close? Did you almost make it?
I just airballed it.
I'm like, just, dear God, please, let's just get him a basket.
His second shot missed too, but the third was a charm. A three-point no-doubter. And Jason wasn't done yet. Not by a long shot.
If I wasn't there to witness it, I wouldn't have believed it, you know.
You caught fire.
I just caught fire. I was hot as a pistol.
Jason ended up shooting 6 three-pointers. One right after the other. He had 20 points total, and each time a shot went in, his teammates and the crowd went a little crazier. His last basket, right at the buzzer, created total mayhem. Because he is autistic, Jason says he's used to feeling different, but never this different. Never this wonderful. Steve Hartman, CBS News, Rochester, New York.
Thank you for listening. For further information, please contact ACEP at www.acep.org.